did. Okay. And you told me to. Okay. So chapter 26, Isaac and Abimelech. Whoever has the first reading, read verse 1 in chapter 26.
Now there was a famine in the land, besides the previous famine that had occurred in the days of Abraham. So Isaac went to Gerar to Abimelech, king of the Philistines.
Okay, so a famine had forced Isaac to move from Beersheba. To Beer-lahai Roy, which was in the Negev Desert. And, you know, I don't have my maps up here anymore. But if you remember on the map, the Negev Desert was way down at the bottom, where Israel comes like this at the bottom. Okay, and that was the Negev, and still is the Negev Desert today. Nothing there is of any interest. I shouldn't say that. But anyway, it's not a good spot. You know, if you want to go camp out there in tents, and they have tent meetings and that with the Christians, they can do that. But so he moved to the Negev Desert, where... remember, before he moved to the desert, he was in this Beer-lahai Roy, where he'd been staying since Abraham's death. Remember, his father died, he was in there, and now he's into the region of Gerar. Gerar, you can think of, because we don't hear that name anymore in our society, or excuse me, in our times in Israel, Gerar, but it's right next to Hebron. And you all heard of Hebron, because it's always in the news, because it's always getting attacked by the... you know, Palestinians. Mm-hmm. So that's where he is now. He's right next to Hebron. Okay? And this king Abimelech was not the same king Abimelech from a few chapters ago in chapter 21. Okay? That was the one that Abraham had encountered earlier. They really don't believe this is the same king, because right when Abraham encountered the king Abimelech in the past, Isaac was around 3 years old, okay? And Isaac, we know, remember now, he's a lot older because he married Rebekah, and when he married Rebekah, he was 60 when she became pregnant. So that's how many years have transpired. It's hard to tell sometimes when you jump from one sentence to another, and it seems like it's just there, okay? But it's moved along now, actually another generation, so to speak. So Isaac is at least 61 at this point. So it's not the same king Abimelech. After all these years, it's really doubtful that the same king Abimelech is still alive, because they're no longer living in hundreds and hundreds of years here. Remember, it's starting to go down to more normal time spans now. Abimelech may have also been a dynastic name of the Philistine rulers. You know how there's so many countries like China and that? They have dynasties, and the name just keeps following each generation down through the dynasties. And they're all the same name. They're just number one, number two, whatever. They got another little added on name along with it. So that may be what they're doing here, is that this is a dynastic ruler's name. Or it could have been the son of the previous king Abimelech, and he's just got the same name. But apparently Isaac approached this Philistine king now to see what he could do, because there's a famine in the land, very serious thing. And he must have considered also the possibility of traveling down to Egypt, because he thought maybe he could get a better deal there from the rulers of Egypt for help, for aid. Egypt could offer him more than the impoverished land in which he and the Philistines are living. But, you know, what happens, okay? He goes to the king, and go ahead and read verses 2 through 5. Let's see what happens.
And the Lord appeared to him and said, "Do not go down to Egypt. Stay in the land of which I shall tell you. Sojourn in this land, and I will be with you and bless you. For to you and to your descendants I will give all these lands, and I will establish the oath which I swore to your father Abraham. and I will multiply your descendants as the stars of heaven, and will give your descendants all these lands, and by your descendants all the nations of the earth shall be blessed. Because Abraham obeyed me and kept my charge, my commandments, my statutes, and my laws.
So the Lord gave Isaac specific instructions here. Don't you wish he'd do that to you sometimes? How many times do you ask him and you're still waiting for an answer? It'd be kind of neat to hear this clear cut, do not go there. It would keep us things a lot simpler for us. But the Lord gave Isaac specific instructions forbidding him from entering into a relationship with the Egyptians. He didn't want none of that anymore. So this presented Isaac now with a pressure-packed decision, because he's being asked to trade immediate solutions. You know, this guy can help me. I can go over here to Egypt and they can help me. My people are going to starve. He's asking to trade now immediate solutions to a very serious problem of famine. Traded for a promise which was really nowhere near as tangible from where he's sitting. It's just a promise somewhere. Today we say it's in the cloud, you know. It's in the cloud. You ever think about prophetic words being in the cloud, in God's cloud? Or we think of the cloud as they have with all the computer stuff today. Well, Isaac and his family can't eat promises. There's a famine. He's got to do something, okay? Don't we feel like that sometimes? Like you're really up against the wall and say, God, you've got to answer me now. And I need an answer that makes sense, not none of these vague things, you know. I need a clear-cut answer, because you don't get it. This is serious. We've got to have an answer now. You know, like God doesn't know what's going on. So the choice here for Isaac was straightforward. He could throw in his lot with Abimelech, king of the Philistines, or he could go to Pharaoh and the Egyptians, or the Lord. So to us, the decision really seems easy, because we're looking at it down the road way after that. But Isaac was faced with a growling stomach and starving dependents. The decision was a much more difficult one for him that we may not always realize so easily. So what did he do? He chose to stand by the God who had repeatedly proved himself faithful in the past. And in verse 6, it tells us, so Isaac stayed in Gerar. So there he was, hanging out around Hebron. In verse 7, it talks about the fact that, like Abraham before Isaac, Isaac pretends that his wife was his sister, lands himself in hot water with the king who found out the truth. Where do you think Isaac learned that trick? We have to be careful sometimes what kind of examples we set as parents. What kind of behavior, what are we displaying that our children pick up on, and down the road as they become adults, they're repeating that same behavior. It's possible he may have heard the story about his father's actions in the past and thought, hey, that didn't seem like a bad idea when push comes to shove. Okay, we'll do that. Or maybe it's none of those things. Maybe it's a generational spirit. I don't know if any of you have ever had any experiences with that, but a lot of people have generational spirits, sometimes several, that go through the family lines, and they'll continue through the family lines until someone is delivered from them. When you're delivered from it, it breaks at that point. It doesn't go beyond that down the generations anymore. But unfortunately, because there's so little teaching about it in the churches today, people aren't always aware of what's going on and don't know how to go get the right kind of help to, you know, do what's necessary to be free of the generational spirits. So because of this lie now that Isaac tells, saying that, you know, his wife is his sister, he lived under a lot of psychological pressure. He was in constant fear for his life. It was that fear was compounded by the knowledge that he was living a lie, and he was in danger of being exposed as a cheat and a deceiver. Have you ever been there in your life? Have you ever done something or told a lie that you spent a lot of time walking in fear that people might find out the truth. And if they find out the truth, what's going to happen? Are they going to just want to have nothing to do with you? You know, you live in fear like that. Well, let's look at his exposure. Does anybody have verse 8?
Yes.
Go ahead and read that.
When Isaac had been there a long time, Abimelech, king of the Philistines, looked down from a window and saw Isaac caressing his wife, Rebekah.
He's exposed. He's exposed, okay. See, at this point, the only thing different here from when Abraham did that with Sarah is Sarah was already in the harem. Rebecca's not in the harem. She's living there in the city, the town, whatever, but she's not in the harem. And God didn't want her in the harem. So he allows his exposure, and King Abimelech is really angry when he finds out the truth, and he summons Isaac, and he says to him, "What is this you've done to us? Like, you know, what kind of disaster are you going to bring on us? Because we've heard about your God. We don't want to mess with any of that." And so what did he do? He gave orders that no one was to touch Rebekah or he would be put to death. There are some differences in the two instances. The one I already mentioned, Abimelech doesn't, have Rebekah in the harem, as happened with Sarah. And the other difference here is that Isaac is not rewarded with silver and gold and all that kind of stuff. And he's not allowed to settle where he pleased as Abraham had been. You remember what happened when Abraham did that. You know, he came out of that smelling like a rose. He got all kinds of riches given to him. And hey, pick of the land you want, have what you want. You know, they didn't want any trouble with his God. But that didn't happen here with Isaac. He didn't get any of those perks. So go ahead, whoever has verses 12 through 15, and let's read those.
Isaac planted crops in that land, and the same year reaped 100-fold, because the Lord blessed him. The man became rich, and his wealth continued to grow until he became very wealthy. He had so many flocks and herds and servants that the Philistines envied him. So all the wells that his father's servants had dug in the time of his father Abraham, the Philistines stopped up and filling them with earth.
It's interesting what we see here in these few verses. It's not a long period of time that had to go by. It's immediately after this very serious famine they're having, the Lord prospered Isaac in the midst of it. That's something for us to really think about today, as things will continue and over time to get worse and worse. And God's promises to us is, he can do for us like he did for the Hebrews when they were in Goshen and all the plagues were happening in Egypt, and it never touched them in the midst of it. And here there's a terrible famine, and yet the Lord is prospering Isaac. Because the neighbors didn't appreciate his success. I mean, wouldn't he be a little jealous? They stopped up his wells. Isaac's now under personal pressure. He had to live in the midst of people who despised him and people who despised his success. He must have had a real sense of alienation. Just think about it. You're living like that, and everywhere you look, there's famine or devastation of some kind, and everybody around you is suffering greatly, and you're prospering. And everybody hates you for it. I don't think you would feel like you fit in. You must feel very alienated. And then he goes on to tell us in verse 16, "Then Abimelech said to Isaac, 'Move away from us. You have become too powerful for us.'" See, they're starting to get scared now. Isaac was getting too rich. He was getting too powerful for Abimelech. Abimelech's starting to get a little nervous. So Isaac now moves out to the valley of Gerar. He moves out a little farther. And while he sets about establishing himself out there, his men redig the wells that had been filled up. Because Abraham had originally dug all those wells way back in the beginning. They were all his. Then after Abraham died and things changed, they came and they filled up all these wells. It loses some of its, intensity of how nasty that was on us, because we don't live in a culture like that. We just turn on a faucet and we have water. But when you're nomads and you're desert people, both your family and your animals and everything depend on water, and those wells were very far apart. They were very scarce. So for someone to come and fill them up and stop them up, and that still happens today to us in different ways, in spiritual ways, that there might be a particular way God is prospering you. It could be with a job or finances or good health or a particular gifting or ministry. God's prospering you with that, and the enemy comes along and he finds a way to stop up that well, to just stop it right up, because he thinks he's going to stop the flow. Well, just like Isaac, sometimes you have to go to war for it, and sometimes you have to sit back and let God go to war for you. It all depends on what God tells us in that particular moment. He not only had his men redig all those wells that had been filled, but he renames them. Why do you think he renamed those wells? Because they all had names. What's the difference what a silly well is named?
I wonder in the back of my mind, it says it gave them the same names which his father had given them, so I'm assuming that they had changed the names after they stopped them up.
Yes.
And I'm wondering, just based on what I understand of what God does, he gives names to places and things for specific reasons, for
yes.
specific blessings. So it's like reiterating mm-hmm. that blessing, like maybe, and I don't know what the names are, obviously, but because mm-hmm. it doesn't tell us, but maybe it says plentiful water.
That's right.
Whatever that may be, or healthy water, or you don't
That's
know.
Right.
And
That's
I'm
right.
sure that there was a reason.
Or never-ending supply or something
right.
like that.
Right.
You know, I love it that so many years ago, the Lord took me into, just by different circuitous ways, learning about the importance of names, whether it's people's names or places' names or nations' names, and how we today have a responsibility to keep calling forth those names. Here's one example. Great Britain. Great Britain, what is their thing again? It has something to do with king, kingly, royalty. Can't remember exactly what it is, but when people go there and they walk that nation and they prayer walk that nation and they're claiming it back for the Lord again, they remind the nation, the land, the trees, the people, the air, the birds, us, and God. This is what that was named for. This is what this land was. God names a nation after the qualities that nation is going to be known for or give off originally, okay? And so it's important for us today to redig wells, in a sense, whether it's in our nation or our state or our family or our own life, because how many times our parents gave us a name. But as we're growing up, depending on what we go through in life, depending on what kind of a childhood we have, what happens to us as young adults even, we get names that God didn't give us. Other people give us names. You're stupid. You're fat. You're never going to amount to anything. You are such a klutz. You're a thorn in my side. How many names have people given us over time? And if it's given over and over and over enough times, it becomes our identity. And a child grows up totally different than what God ordained them to be, because they're walking in an identity of a well of identity that the enemy stuffed up with something and renamed and has convinced them that that's who they are. And people can go through their whole life till they're 90 years old if they don't ever learn about it and realize and know they don't have to continue in that. Because what I love about God is He still is in the business of giving us new names. And when God gives you a new name, it's awesome. But sometimes we don't even understand it. So then what happens is we got to go research that name. And when we research it, we go, whoa, that's what you're saying about me? It's really encouraging. And it's something then that we have to remind ourselves when the enemy comes back and wants to put those lies on us again. So names are very important, whether it's a person or a well. So yes, you're right, Jeanette, in what you were saying. There's a reason that they would rename those. Well, what happens today in the Muslim world? One of the first things we learn when we were doing those incognito trips in the Middle East. All throughout history, from the very beginning of Islam, even up to current times, when they would conquer a land, when they went in, they conquered most of Europe, and it was all Islam back then, which, you know, part of that was what, you know, happened in the Crusades and that. Okay, so they go in and they conquer and they take over, and the first thing they went and did was they would go into all the churches and make them into a mosque. And they would pull down anything that was like Christian symbolism, because back then all the churches and that had all the Christian stuff in it, statues and different things and symbols. And there's a mosque you see all the time in the news that it's world famous. Everybody has heard of it. It's called the Blue Mosque, and it's in Turkey. And it's the one that's a huge, great big mosque, and it looks like four rocket silos at the sides. Okay, you go in there and you can see where they had taken and stripped off the walls all the Christian stuff, and on top of it they had put shields that all had names glorifying Allah. That's what they do. See, they're renaming it.
Do you think maybe it's also, for instance, we go to the moon, we plant an American flag there. We
That's important.
Conquer during the World War II, we planned a flag there.
Yep.
It's claiming ownership. And
it
I wonder
is.
If through that name they're claiming ownership for God.
They are. What they're doing, if you think about it, it's a spiritual thing. But the more you learn about it and understand it, it's very, very serious. Because what they're doing is, when they do that, they're dedicating that to Allah or whatever other pagan, okay? They're establishing a beachhead. Okay, what happened in our country, America? What happened with the very first boat people that came over? What was the first thing they did when they got out of that boat at Cape Henry? They brought a huge cross. They put it on the beach. It's still there to this day at Cape Henry. They got out. They planted the cross. They had a worship service. And they dedicated in the most beautiful ceremony, when you read about it, what they said. They dedicated it to God from day one. Day one. Okay? But then the enemy wants to move in, just like in the natural. When an army moves in, what do? They establish a beachhead. Okay, first they have a landing party, and if there's not a lot of opposition, they establish a beachhead, and then that becomes a stronghold. And so all these countries, including ours, we have spiritual strongholds over the land. But the good news is that when, you know, you can go in Jesus' name, and you can do what He tells you to do, and they are gone. But it's just a matter of knowing that. So that's why it's so important. A couple days ago, I think Emmy Gronert sent out an email about the schools. Did any of you get that? Mm-hmm. About praying for the safety of our schools here, because some things, I guess, have been brought to the attention at Iron Mountain and Kingsford schools, that there's something. I don't know what the whole story is. Okay? And that's, it's important, you know, some of you know, because I get discouraged and I you know, I have to be careful sometimes, because every summer before school starts, you know, we go to the schools and we pray. And I can only ever get one person to come with me. And I don't even have kids in school. Okay? So we go to Iron Mountain, we go to Kingsford, we go to Norway, we go to Woodland Elementary, we go to the one up on the hill there where Diana Scott's got her stuff. I forget the name of it. Okay? Why do we do that? Because we go there and we walk around and we claim that for God. And any of the kids that are with us, the little kids, that's what we tell them. Okay, hey, what do you want to pray for this school? You know, in six easy words, whatever you want to say. To teach them that principle, that's their school. This is the principle. God gives you the authority. You go, because the enemy is already trying to infiltrate. You walk those grounds. You claim it for the Lord. You know, you seek the Lord first, and he'll give you what you need to say and pray and do. We go blow shofars there, too. I don't care if somebody thinks I'm nuts. Who cares? No, the worst they can do is lock me up. But that's what we need to do more of, whether it's our own home, our property, you know, because it's that concept. And that's why in our nation today, right now, there's this humongous move of God that's going on with taking back our land through prayer, but it's prayer that's declaration and proclamation and decrees, and it's powerful. And you just watch what's going to happen. The Lord's called a 40-day fast right now for California. God gets specific sometimes. California. See, to me, I'm like, don't even bother me with that. I can't stand those people in California. I don't want to be, you know, doing anything for them. But he's calling for that, and Christians all across this nation started March 1st, taking it seriously. It's not just a normal, like, fast from food for 40 days. Here's what he said. I want you for 40 days to fast from all negative words and negative thoughts. That's hard for me, especially when I turn on the news in the morning and I'm like, I want to throw stuff at the TV. But, okay, because he's bringing a revival that's already begun in California, and it's important what's going to come from there, and it's key. Is it not interesting that right now, President Trump was in California, first time he's ever gone to that state of California? It's not a coincidence. God does everything in time. So yes, it's important. The naming, you know, they got the wells, they're giving them different names. You can give your home a name. Ask God to tell you what it is. He'll give you a good one. Okay, so however, what happens now? Isaac has his men redig the wells, but a running feud develops now between Isaac's herdsmen and those of the valley, because Gerar was located on the edge of a desert. Water was really as precious as gold would be to us today. And if someone dug a well, he was staking a claim to the land. Some wells even had locks on them to keep thieves from stealing the water. So to stop or plug up someone's well was literally an act of war in those days to those people. It was an act of war. And it was one of the most serious crimes in the land. It's interesting to note that the names of the first two wells, they did have names, Jeanette, the first two wells, Esek, and Esek means contention. Strife. And the second well was named Sitna. Sitna means hostility, enmity. And both those caused fighting. See, who renamed them those names? Not Isaac. He renamed them back to what their names originally had been. See, the enemy gave them names. What the name is, it's spoken words are powerful. Very powerful, even when it comes from the enemy. So Isaac had every right to fight back now when the Philistines ruined his wells. He had every legal right to do so. But instead, he didn't do that. He just chose to keep moving in order to keep the peace. It's like, I'm not going to fight over that. Let's just move on and keep the peace, okay? Well, we too must ask God at times for wisdom to know when we're to withdraw and when we are to stand and fight. Because sometimes God will say, stand and fight, and I will be with you. I'll give you the victory. Other times he says, don't do a thing. Step aside. Let me work here. So Isaac moves on and he digs a third well. And now this time no attacks happen. So he stays there. And he names it Rehoboth. Rehoboth means room. It means broad places. It means running water. See? People took a lot into account when they named their children. Up until the last 100 years in this country, that's the way it used to be too. You would ask God what name, because the name that you gave your child, the meaning of that name would be qualities, character traits that you wanted that child to have and grow up with. Just like the Native American Indians used to do. Same thing. We've lost that. So finally now there's enough room for everyone. And in the end, the Philistines respected Isaac for his patience. Then in verse 23, we see Isaac now moves to Beersheba. And then in verse 24, the Lord appears to him and reminds him again not to fear, that he is with him and he will bless him. How many times does God have to remind us? Some of us he's reminds a few times, and some of us he has to remind a lot more, because we forget more quickly what his promises are to us. So at Beersheba, three important encounters take place between God and man. First, back in Genesis 21, this is the very spot where God appeared to Hagar. Hagar had an encounter with God at the well there. And then in Genesis 26, he appears to Isaac, okay, as where we are now. And further on, we won't get to in this study, but in Genesis 46, that's the same spot he appeared to Jacob. So you see, nothing's random with God. Everything he has a purpose, and he revisits places. Places are important. There's no coincidences. So what happens? Isaac has this encounter with God. He builds an altar there. He pitches his tent and he digs a well. And all signs are signs that he plans to stay. And then in verse 26, Abimelech, along with his commander-in-chief, I think his name was Phicol or something, okay, and his advisor, all three of them pay Isaac a visit. This is a show of authority here. You've got the king, his commander-in-chief, and his top advisor. Woo! This is important, okay? They want to be threatening. And we do see a new name here that we didn't see before, and that was the king's advisor, or Huzza. Isaac asks, why have you come to me? Since they had sent him away before. They sent him away and he left and everything was fine. So he's like, why are you coming to me now? Okay, who has verses 28 through 31? Go and read those.
They answered, "We saw clearly that the Lord was with you. So we said, there ought to be a sworn agreement between us and you. Let us make a treaty with you, that you will do us no harm, just as we did not harm you, but always treated you well and sent you away peacefully. And now you are blessed by the Lord." Isaac then made a feast for them, and they ate and drank. Early the next morning, the men swore an oath to each other. Then Isaac sent them on their way, and they went away peacefully.
So his enemies wanted to make a peace treaty. Isaac was quick to respond, turning the occasion into a real celebration at this point. Okay? So maybe he's using some wisdom here. He could have said, forget you guys. You treated me ill. You kicked me out. You told me to come out here. Leave me alone. Go, leave me alone, you know? Something for us to think about. We should be just as receptive to those who want to make peace with us. Maybe they were our enemy at one point. Maybe they treated us badly. Maybe they gossiped about us to other people and told untrue things, okay? But when God's influence in our own lives attracts people, and that's what happened here, they saw his God, that he was favored, he was blessed, and they were attracted. They were attracted. They wanted to hang out with him. So when God's influence in our lives attracts people, even sometimes our enemies will be attracted. We also must take the opportunity to reach out to them with God's love. Sometimes we don't want to. Sometimes we've been burned so bad, it's like, come on, God, give me a break. Don't ask me to do this. Okay? But Isaac also faced parental pressures. In verse 34, we're told that at the age of 40, Esau marries two Hittite women. And this tells us that they were a source of grief to Isaac and Rebecca. You know, why were they a source of grief, do you think?
They very potentially brought in gods of the kind of the Hittites.
Yes, they were pagans.
They didn't treat maybe their son the way that they felt that they should. Much the same as we have our kids marry and we don't necessarily approve sometimes and we feel that it's not a wise choice.
That is it. And the most important thing out of it is that they were pagans and they weren't supposed to commingle with pagans because of what happened all the time in the centuries behind them. Every time Israel got off track, it's because they started to blend in with the pagan culture and intermarry, and they became adopting pagan gods. And so they don't want this to happen again. This also shows us Esau's willfulness here. He did not do the proper thing. He did not marry within the tribe or within the clan. Remember, we learned that was the custom. He didn't do that. He's breaking all the rules here. He's his willfulness. It also shows Isaac's not being able to prevent his son from doing this. Remember, it was the custom for the parents to choose their son's bride. Whether you like who they chose or not. And we see that today in some countries, you know, like Pakistan and India, that's still the custom today. The parents choose who's going to marry who when they're little children, and you don't have a word to say about it. Obviously, Esau had his own ideas, and he wasn't going to follow any of the routine here. So we move on to chapter 27. Jacob gets Isaac's blessing. Isaac's family began as a good family. It was a marriage made with care, remember that. The careful and the prayerful preparations for the marriage of Isaac and Rebecca, and then the children were bathed in prayer. So it was a good family, a good marriage. They followed God. Remember the prayers their parents had expressed on their behalf. We were told that Isaac pleaded with the Lord for his wife. She couldn't have any children. He pleaded with the Lord because she was barren. And Rebecca, during her pregnancy, what did she do? She inquired of the Lord. Remember, why is this happening to me, this turmoil that's going on here with these babies, you know? So she said, why? She inquired of the Lord. So they went to the Lord for their source and the problems they encountered. So what happened then to this family to bring them to this atmosphere where we find them now, where it's all whispering and intrigue and sneaking around? How did they get there? We will see that a major part of the problem was that this family was made up of people who were committed to their own ends. They were so committed to their own ends that those ends were to be achieved by any means and all means, regardless of who might be abused in the process. Their own ends, they were committed more to their own ends than they were to following God. Easy for us to get off track on that. Go ahead and read verses 1 through 4, whoever has those.
When Isaac was old and his eyes were so weak he could no longer see, he called for Esau, his older son, and said to him, "My son." "Here I am," he answered. Isaac said, "I am now an old man and don't know the day of my death. Now then, get your weapons, your quiver and bow, and go out into the open country to hunt some wild game for me. Prepare me the kind of tasty food I like and bring it to me to eat so that I may give you my blessings before I die."
So the Lord had stated clearly before the twins were born, if we remember a couple of chapters back, that the elder would serve the younger. That was back in Genesis 25. Well, that wouldn't make any sense if God told you that, because it's totally against the law and the custom and tradition and everything else. So who are you going to believe? But apparently Isaac was not prepared to accept this piece of divine determination that God made. He was determined instead that the blessing should belong to Esau, the firstborn. And he would follow instead the law of tradition. So in the culture of this time, although the firstborn son was entitled to the birthright, it was not actually his until the blessing was pronounced. He knew it was going to be his all his life, but it legally wasn't his until that blessing is pronounced. And before the blessing was given, the father could take the birthright away from the eldest son and give it to somebody who would be a more deserving son if there was a reason to. But after the blessing was given, the birthright could no longer be taken away. Once you gave the blessing, it stayed there. That's why fathers usually waited until late in life to pronounce the blessing, or waited until they kind of thought they were on their deathbed or close to it. Then they felt it was more safe now to give that blessing, because I don't think things will change too much between now and the time I die. It was a very serious thing. So there's a little deception here on Isaac's part also, because the custom was to have, when you're going to give the blessing now, you have all the sons gather around the father, not just the one who's going to get the inheritance. All the sons are around the father. Jacob should have been summoned also to receive his lesser share in that blessing, and any other sons that would have been involved. Okay? So something here was out of alignment from the get-go. Esau knew that he had traded the birthright. He didn't forget that. And he had sworn the solemn oath by yielding to his father's request now, or back then, to go out and hunt the food without telling anyone about it. He was hoping that all might yet go well for him, because he knew he had sold his birthright back, remember, chapters ago. Now Dad says, "Come on, go out and catch me some food and make me a nice stew." So Esau's thinking, well, maybe all isn't lost yet. So there's a lot of deception here. Was Esau calculating that the leadership, if not the inheritance, but maybe the leadership of the family, might at least be preserved to him after his father dies? Still, he had to keep his bargain with his brother and hand over a double share of the property to him? Maybe. Perhaps. Maybe not. We don't know if Isaac and Rebecca were aware that the birthright had been traded by Esau to his brother. We're not told that. But it's hard to imagine how such an event could have been kept a secret all those years. They had to know. I think they did, because if they didn't know, why would Rebecca sneak around so much with encouraging, you know, Jacob like she did, Ed?
Yeah, and if Isaac didn't know, why would he do what he did?
That's right. So it had to be a lot of deception all going on over the years.
There was deception
Yep. So then in verses 5 through 17, you know, Esau went out hunting and Rebecca went scheming. He's over here hunting, she's over here scheming. Rebecca tells Jacob to bring her two young goats for her to prepare, and have Jacob bring them to Isaac so that he can receive the blessing through deception. Jacob tells her that Isaac will know it's not Esau And then Rebekah has Jacob go through that whole thing about covering his hands and his necks with the goat's hair and put on Esau's clothes. She had it all figured out. She must have been thinking about this for quite some time because she had it all worked out, you know. So what happened to the beautiful young woman who left Nahor in Mesopotamia to marry Isaac? What happened to her? How did she turn into the scheming, unprincipled, bitter woman that we're seeing here in this incident? How did that happen? She had become totally dedicated to her own ends, even to the point of feeling that she could humiliate her own husband and blatantly manipulate her own sons here. So setting father against son, setting brother against brother, didn't really seem to worry her at all. Because in her mind, it seemed like the end justified the means in her book, in her way of thinking. So like his scheming mother, Jacob was prepared to do whatever it takes. He hesitates briefly, and he questions her plan, but for the wrong reasons he questions it. He isn't concerned about the wrongness of it, only that he may get caught. Mm-hmm. And that's what he's trying to determine here. So like his father, Esau was happy to live in the area of self-gratification. The consequences and the villainous activities of this family were quickly becoming apparent here. Families are intended to love each other, not to lie to one another. They're made to complement each other, not to compete against one another. Dennis, do you have verses 18 through 29? Would you read those?
He went to his father and said, "My father." "Yes, my son," he answered. "Who is it?" Jacob said to his father, "I am Esau, your firstborn. I have done as you told me. Please sit up and eat some of my game so that you may give me your blessing." Isaac asked his son, "How did you find it so quickly, my son?" The Lord your God gave me success," he replied. Then Isaac said to Jacob, "Come near so I can touch you, my son, to know whether you are really my son Esau or not." Jacob went close to his father Isaac, who touched him and said, "The voice is the voice of Jacob, but the hands are the hands of Esau." He did not recognize him, for his hands were hairy like those of his brother Esau, so he blessed him. "Are you really my son Esau?" he asked. "I am," he replied. Then he said, "My son, bring me some of your game to eat so that I may give you my blessing." Jacob brought it to him and he ate, and he brought some wine and he drank. Then his father Isaac said to him, "Come here, my son, and kiss me." So he went to him and kissed him. When Isaac caught the smell of his clothes, he blessed him and said, "Ah, the smell of my son is like the smell of a field that the Lord has blessed. May God give you of heaven's dew and of earth's richness, an abundance of grain and new wine. May nations serve you and peoples bow down to you. Be Lord over your brothers, and may the sons of your mother bow down to you. May those who curse you be cursed, and those who bless you be blessed."
So Isaac's in his tent being conned all the way around here, okay? But he's a little suspicious, though, okay? Perhaps living in his family had taught him to be suspicious most of the time. I would think maybe so. But in spite of his suspicion, Isaac was fooled. He was humiliated because he relied entirely on his senses, every one of which betrayed him. What did he do? He felt. He smelled. He listened. He tasted. Such is the lot of those who live trivially and ignore the word that the Lord has spoken and the oaths that have been solemnly sworn. You have a question? Comment?
Well, it's interesting what you were saying earlier about the way it was supposed to be done with all the sons present. And he purposefully didn't do that. If they had all been present, this wouldn't have worked.
That's right. That's right.
Interesting.
The slippery slope of deception. It just takes one thing, and then it links to another, and then the deception grows bigger, or the lies grow bigger, and more damage is done. So what happens? After this, Esau returns, he learns what happened, and he begs his father for a blessing. I mean, he weeps and begs his father for a blessing. And Isaac trembles as he really learns the reality now of the deception, because he can't take the blessing back. He's stuck. Esau is so angry with Jacob that he promises to kill him after Isaac dies. Well, Rebecca, resourceful Rebecca, ever alert and resourceful as always, she hears what was said, and she instructs Jacob to leave home and put as much distance between himself and his brother, and she tells him to go to her brother Laban in Haran, which is why we moved our thing today, because Jacob flees to Haran. He'll regret that day too. Then she's dishonest with Isaac. She's pretending to be distressed about Jacob picking up with some of the women that his brother was associating with, implying that Jacob might marry a Hittite woman, so it's better if he goes and goes and finds a bride back in the clan, the family clan. So what does Isaac do? He blesses him and he sends him to Laban to get a wife. Jacob packs his bags and he heads east as fast as he can go, hoping his brother's not going to catch up with him in the process and kill him. And although Jacob got the blessing he wanted, deceiving his father in the long run cost him dearly. It cost him dearly because as the story goes on and unfolds, he never saw his mother again, ever. His brother wanted to kill him. He was later deceived by his uncle Laban, later on in the story. His family became torn by strife. Esau became the founder of an enemy nation, hence the Muslims today, the Arabs. And Jacob was exiled from his family for many, many years. And lastly, and ironically, Jacob would have received the birthright and the blessing anyway, because of back in chapter 25, verse 23, the Lord said that it was to go to him. How God would have done it, I don't know. But if God said it, he would have found a way. So imagine how different Jacob's life would have been had he and his mother waited for God to work in his way and in his time. So this family, which started out so well and disintegrated into disaster, is really a powerful witness to us, because this story is almost completely empty of God's presence. We don't hear much about them anymore, encountering God, going before God, asking for his help. Empty of his presence. And none of the characters in here, you know, none of them turn to God for guidance, nor does God communicate once with them. As in chapter 21, when he informed Abraham that Hagar's banishment was his will, God communicated. He's not communicating with any of them. Because he goes figure, if they turn a deaf ear to him, he'll turn a deaf ear to them too. He's not communicating. Yet just as important as in that story, at stake here also was the future of God's special people and the continuance of his promises. All along throughout the times and the centuries, we'll see this, where God's promises are at stake, something the enemy's trying to do to change and disrupt God's plan. So we are again face to face with the enigma of divine grace. Yes, that he shall be blessed is without doubt the chapter's key phrase, that he shall be blessed. So behind the scheming and the conniving of man, the sovereign Lord was really still at work. The line of God's election would move on through Jacob and not through Esau. God will have his way. And Jacob, whom God had said would be the next in line in the chain of divine purpose, He had arrived in that exact position. He was now on his way to the family home where he would eventually find the bride through whom the promised line would be extended. God knows what he's doing. He's working it all out. We are left for the moment in the sole company of those who were the objects of his grace, so that we may ponder or we may think about their unworthiness. Weren't they unworthy? And that we would be led from that to confess our own unworthiness, our own sins. And the lesson behind all of this is that God delights. He delights to have us work in glad cooperation with him. But should we freely choose not to cooperate? Well, he'll let us do that sometimes, won't he? And we will eventually discover that God works despite our having chosen not to allow him to work with us. Ever been there and realized it too late? Comments, questions, anybody? What do you think about this drama?
I come to thoughts. One, it's interesting, the birthright, isn't that the core of the issue that's there today?
Yes.
I mean, that's the very same thing. Whose is it?
Mm-hmm.
And wasn't resolved then, isn't resolved now.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing that occurred to me, you were the four, God's going to have his way no matter what, and he will work through imperfect people, people indeed who ignore him and do the wrong thing, just as you just said. And that gives us, should give us all hope.
Yes, aren't you glad?
Regardless of what we do, he's going to have his way, and his will be fulfilled.
I'm so glad he works through imperfect people, because otherwise I'd be left out. I mean, we should be encouraged that as long as we always go back to him, eventually, at some point, he's going to straighten the mess out that we've made. Anyone else have a question or a comment?
I work with seniors, and I see this same situation play out more times than not. It destroys families, it separates siblings, and it goes down for generations and generations after. And sometimes there really wasn't much to even feud over, but yet it totally, my husband's grandmother, as a matter of fact. She passed away at 97. The only thing she had was less than $100 in the bank and an incontinent dog, I kid you not. And brothers that live here in Quinnesec, literally Walmart is not big enough for more than one of them to be in the store at the same time over the dog.
It is sad, isn't it, when you think of how many times families are torn apart by inheritance issues. You know,
things that aren't important.
That's right. That's right. It is. I have anybody wants a copy of it, they can. I just thought it's kind of a cute way to remember an idea. It's called the buzzard, the bat, and the bumblebee. The buzzard. If you put a buzzard in a pen that's 6 feet by 8 feet and is entirely open on the top, the bird, in spite of its ability to fly, will be an absolute prisoner. The reason is that a buzzard always begins a flight from the ground with a run of 10 to 12 feet. That's the only way he can get lift off. So without space to run, as its habit is, it will not even attempt to fly. It won't even try. And it will remain a prisoner for life in a small jail with no top on it. Now the bat, the ordinary bat that flies around at night, a remarkable nimble creature in the air, he cannot take off from a level place. If it is placed on the floor or flat ground, all it can do is shuffle about helplessly and no doubt painfully, which is why you see them sometimes in Walmart. And they're on the floor and they're hopping up and down about this far and they're squawking and they're nasty, nasty. Look like they're going crazy. You know, that's why they can't take off from a flat surface, okay? And painfully until it reaches some slight elevation from which it can throw itself into the air. That's how the bats do it. Then at once it takes off like a flash. But the bumblebee, if dropped into an open tumbler, will be there until it dies, unless it is taken out. Open tumbler. It never sees the means of escape at the top, but persists in trying to find some way out through the sides near the bottom. And it just will keep going and trying to find a way to get out down there. And it will seek a way where none exists until it completely destroys itself. And the us. In many ways, we are like the buzzard, the bat, and the bumblebee. We struggle about with all our problems and frustrations, never realizing that all we have to do is look up. That's the answer. The escape route and the solution to any problem. Just look up. Look up to the Lord. And we don't have to stay a prisoner anymore. Anybody want a copy of this at all? I'll pass it around. You can just take one if you want one. I just thought it was kind of cute because it's a lesson for us. Because how many times are we caught in the middle? And we're frantically scrambling every which way to find the answer and the way out. And the worse, the more intense the problems become, we all know in our heart to look up. We know better. But yet we're unable to sometimes because we're so traumatized by the circumstances that we can't think clearly. You know? Just look up. Yes, Bridget.
Just recently, our bank was going through the merger, and it's like a whole new job, and things are very stressful. So many times the Lord would say, "Eyes up here." I'd be doing something, eyes up here. It's like, "Oh, okay, you're still here."
That is true. That is a fact. And why is it that sometimes it's the last thing we think of? At least I know for myself. So many times. Even though I know better, sometimes it will be the first thing, but sometimes, depending on how intense the rage gets, it's like, I don't think of that first.
We're engineered to do it ourselves. We're made that way. And we got to get to the end of ourselves first. We got to beat ourselves bloody.
Well, that is true. You know, unfortunately, God would rather have us not go through all that. But some of us are slower to get it than others, you know. Sometimes I think he can be speaking to me forever, and I'm so slow. You know? I always say you've got to drop a ton of bricks on me or paint it on a billboard, you know. And it's frustrating. You know what's frustrating to me is like, and maybe some of you feel this way too. I say, "Lord, I don't get it. How come when you want to speak to me and give me a word on Sunday, it's there. I can hear it, okay? But when I need to hear a word from him, like, I need an answer. I'm asking you what to do. How come I'm not hearing?"
What does the CIA say about that?
I don't remember. Need to know. That's right. Well, a lot of times it's a need to know, but I don't put myself in a listening posture because I'm too busy all the time.
But if you had that direct contact, would you feel the need for others?
What do you mean?
We are supposed to be dependent on each other.
Well, yes.
If you constantly have this direct line, what need would you have to receive from others?
Well, I include in that when I say not hear from him, I include in that having other people speak what he once said to me, because I'm a firm believer in that. And that's why, too, I'm trying to be better at being more willing to let go of what my plan is for the day. And that's hard for me because I'm an extremely structured, scheduled, planned person. So that's real hard for me. But I'm trying to get better because I don't know what that, let's say, I'll look at it as an interruption. I don't know what that interruption is packaged to bring me from the Lord. Or maybe for me to bring something to them from the Lord. You know? But, you know, if you're always too busy on your way. Dennis.
Christ is on a billboard down by Manitowoc, Wisconsin, Highway 22. And it's been there since I was a kid, and it's still neat. Some